Thank you, Anna Marie, and I'm Steve Benson, here today with regular co-host, artist, and associate professor of sculpture here at the University of Minnesota, David Feinberg. And our special guest is visiting artist John Knutson. John Knutson is a graduate of Luther College in Iowa, Decorah, Iowa, then graduated from the State University of Iowa, and has worked in a number of places around the world, and particularly at Atelier 17 in Paris. His show is currently running in the Studio Arts Building here at the University of Minnesota. It runs through October 21st. And today we're going to be talking about John Knutson's work, where he gets his inspiration from, maybe his love of toys and oriental rugs and new ways of looking at the cityscape. And if you'd like to join us in our conversation this afternoon, call us at 625-5800. That's 625-5800 outside the metro area, 1-800-247-0785. That's 1-800-247-0785. And if you're outside the state of Minnesota, call us collect at area code 612, then our regular 625-5800 number, and we'll be happy to pick up those charges. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Enjoy being here.
Good. And David, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's let you set the stage for us.
Okay. At the end of the 19th century, there was a movement called Art for Art's Sake. And it gave the artist the right to do what they thought they should do in terms of the content of a work. Previous to this movement, basically art was commissioned by the church or barons or dukes or kings, queens, etc. Following this art for art's sake came a lot of isms. It opened up the door for Picasso or Kandinsky with abstractionism. And followed by abstract expressionism, color field painting, all kinds of isms followed. And I think what John Knutson represents is getting away from the isms and getting into the idea of the individual. And I would say that his work represents art for the sake of the individual. And he has some comments that maybe go in that direction, and I'm going to open it up by asking him, what do you mean by the fact that you call yourself a regionalist?
I think, well, first of all, we're all influenced, whether we like it or not. I think some artists would like to think that they emerge from the womb totally untouched by influences, but from the moment we were young children, we learn language from our parents, and we grow up with all kinds of influences on our lives. And I think that this has an effect on, well, I speak for myself as an artist. I think that some of the images that I use are probably planted on my brain, I suppose, when I was very young, because now as an older person I look back and I can remember things very distinctly in my childhood that now emerge as images. And I guess when I say regionalism, because I grew up, I was born in Brooklyn, and my father was a Lutheran minister. We eventually moved west and wound up in Chicago. That for the most part of my life, I've lived in larger cities. And so I think that has played a very important part on the images I use. So when I say regionalist, I guess I'm talking about a particular area of this country where I've lived, and that the imagery that I use is derived from that, and I make no bones about it. And I use the word regionalist positively. I mean, in the same way we would look at Grant Wood as a regionalist, a spokesman for the Midwest, perhaps rural type artist, or Thomas Hart Benton. I think these are important American artists that I think have been underplayed. I think that they're very important in our culture, and we tend to overlook them. And I think regionalism, I have no negative feeling about that term. I'm the first to admit that I think my work is very regional.
When looking at the city, one always thinks of sort of the ashcan school of artists back the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Mm-hmm. And in looking at your very delightful paintings, mm-hmm. paintings are very bright and colorful. There's a very childlike, almost toy box quality to your cities.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a compliment. I like to think of myself as a child in a man's body. I look on I'm fascinated by, you know, just living today. I think that, for instance, coming to over to the studio this morning on the expressway, I'm fascinated by cars moving on express lanes. I'm fascinated by trucks. I'm fascinated by, you know, all aspects of the city, buildings, watching workers work. This is all, you know, and I guess that fascination is the same thing, I suppose, a child would have. I mean, if you ever watched children when they, you know, watch a building go out, they love to watch cranes, and I still do that. I mean, I'll stand out there just and watch that happening. I think it's terribly exciting, and I think that there's such a rich variety in the city. I think it's a great source for ideas.
John, if you're paying attention to those things, can you still pay attention to what goes on currently in terms of trends, or how do you relate the idea of being an individual? It seems to me that if you're paying attention to these vital experiences and your artwork's based on those, how does that relate to what's happening now?
I read a lot. I mean, I absorb every book on art that I can get my hand on, and I especially picture books. That's what I call art magazines and so forth, picture books. I'm really not terribly influenced by trends. In fact, I try to ignore them. I think they have a negative influence, especially on younger artists. And I can remember as a young student at Luther College, Jackson Pollock was a height on him, you know, and I was doing splash paintings. And I think you have to do that. But ultimately, I think you have to say, you know, you look at artists that influence you, and then you say, yes, you know, I admire their work, but now I have to get, you know, find out where I am, who I am, and do my own kind of work and relate directly to the influences around me, that, such as the city, and come up with my own kind of imagery. So, and I don't like the trendiness today in artwork. I think most of your major art journals spend a lot of time on this. I think, for instance, a lot of it is overblown, and I think in 10 years, a lot of these major trends will be forgotten. There's no substance. And you mentioned the Ashtan School. For instance, John Sloan, I love his works. I mean, I think that he's been so forgotten, it's terrible, but he's starting to come back now because people are collecting his prints. And all of a sudden, he's emerging. Unfortunately, you know, he's been dead many years. But here's an important American artist from that era.
Well, both you and Sloan love subways, elevated right. Subways, and signs.
Right. My religion is riding around on L trains in Chicago. It's like for me being in church. I love to. Some days I'll just go downtown and sit on trains all day long.
John, in your lecture to the studio arts classes the other day, you mentioned that if you had to live in a city, you would like to live on the edge of the city. What do you mean by that?
Well, yesterday I was talking to a class, and I talked about Truman Capote. Somebody asked him once where he would live, the ideal place he would live. He said his comment was on the edge of Detroit. I thought that was a rather unusual statement, because here's a man who could afford to live anywhere. But in fact, what he was saying is that the edge of Detroit or the edge of Chicago or the edge of New York is where is the city in transition. The most exciting things happen on the edge. I mean, if you go downtown Minneapolis, you've got new expensive buildings. We all, you know, by very important architects. Now, that's good. But to me, as an artist, that's boring. I would rather be on the edge of Minneapolis, maybe over on the edge of Hennepin Avenue or wherever, where the bus depot, where you find trucks that are, you know, forgotten, broken down, where things maybe are beginning to happen, maybe where things are dying, and there's that flux happening. To me, that's visually very exciting. And the same in Chicago. I find that my ideas come from, you know, the broken down parts of the city that are in a state of flux, and that's why I mean the edge of the city.
So the brand new Metrodome is not one of your favorite places?
No, I would never paint the Metrodome. Maybe in 200 years when it gets, you know, disheveled, I might come back and do it. But I really prefer that disorganization. I like, for instance, glitzy signs. If you've ever been to Las Vegas, I think that's terribly fascinating. I mean, people would say they're terrible, the neon and all. I love all that stuff. I mean, I couldn't live in it, but I think it's visually fascinating, you know, neon, the neon signage in Las Vegas.
Well, in your prints particularly, you see the smoke. It's the pollution, the industrial smoke, although, and to a certain extent, it's romanticized into going up and joining with the clouds.
Right. I see smoke as a very romantic thing. Because when I was a kid, I grew up, we traveled east every summer. My father was a Lutheran minister, and we brought up in Brooklyn. So every summer, we'd pile in the old 38 Plymouth and head back with six kids, and we'd go through every little town in Pennsylvania. Most of them were steel towns. And to me, I can remember the activity. I love that idea of work, of seeing buildings with smoke billowing out, knowing that men are in working, fabricating. I think that's terribly fascinating. You know, the last time I went through Pittsburgh, it's completely changed. You know, no more smokestacks, no more smoke. Everything is, you know, high tech, and it's totally changed. But my memory of Pittsburgh is when I was a kid. That was coming over the mountain, looking down into the valley, seeing those chimneys belching out smoke. I know that the probably the environmentalists wouldn't like me, but that to me is terribly exciting. And I don't try to make a statement on my paintings. I'm not saying anti-pollution or pollution or anything else. I just am terribly fascinated with chimneys and smoke.
In the lecture yesterday, sarcastically, I think you said you love pollution because it's so fascinating. But I think you were talking about the aesthetics.
Yes, I was. Like, for instance, smoke-filled rooms. Whatever happened to smoke-filled rooms? I mean, now all the rooms all across the United States are terribly sanitized, and I guess I'm not...
Well, in the works that are on display at the Studio Arts Building here at the University of Minnesota, there is only one very prominent piece of vegetation or nature, and that is a very wonderful tree. It reminded me of the great tree of Scandinavian mythology, the great ash tree, the world tree, the Yggdrasil, that is this huge, twining, almost overpowering structure that rises out of cities.
Yes. Well, it's interesting to hear that bit of Scandinavian mythology, and I'm going to certainly read up about that tree. I didn't know anything about it, but now that I've, it might be the subject for another print because it's terribly fascinating. But I love trees. I always plant trees. My wife calls me the Johnny Appleseed of Palette because and she says, you're planting too many trees. I love to plant trees. I love to, just love having them around me. It really bothers me when I see people cutting them down because they're either in the way or they're afraid they're going to fall on the house or something like that. But I just love that. For instance, one of the most fascinating trees is the Kaobab tree, I think, in Africa. It's, you know, it lives to be 200 or 300 years old, and they're wonderfully gnarled and so forth. And I think that's where I got the idea for that particular print. I was watching a program on PBS about that tree and how many animals inhabit that tree. And also, I think it was in part influenced by a 19th century French etcher, Rudolf Bresden, who I admire greatly, who did a lot of this kind of work. So it comes from all sources, really.
If you're going to take somebody from a foreign country who never visited the United States before, where would you take them? What kind of things that would be you would think would be typically American?
Yeah, we've traveled to Europe a lot as a family, and I always try to find things that are indigenous to the culture that I want to see. I want to learn more about them. And we also have friends who live in Europe and come to visit us, and the first thing you say, well, our French friends, we're going to take them to a French restaurant. Well, that's like a busman's holiday, after all. We want to take them to something that's, you know, that you wouldn't find necessarily in Europe. I think things like stock car races are terribly exciting. I love the painted cars, the noise, the whole thing. It's kind of tacky in a way, but I love it, and I think that's really some of the things that are kind of typically American. Another thing I like to do is I like to go to state fairs, hang around barns. You know, I have, my wife is from Iowa. We always go to the Howard County Fair. I love to hang around barns, look at pigs and sheep. I mean, you know, they're terribly fascinating. People who live there, they ignore it. It's like, oh, these animals are just part of. But all of that is fascinating, and I think for somebody to come from a foreign country would be very interested in seeing this kind of thing. And, for instance, Chicago, we don't realize that most of the cities in Europe are very, the buildings are not, we don't have skyscrapers as such. In Paris, you're only allowed to build buildings so high. And that's, of course, what gives Paris a lot of its charm. And also in London, But you come to Chicago, you come to Minneapolis, and you come to New York, and you see these humongous skyscrapers. They're very interesting, and this is something that's totally new to a person from Europe, from European countries. And so I always try to make sure I take them to things like this.
Well, that wonderful fascination that you have for subways and elevators, I know as a boy going to Chicago or New York, the first thing that we always wanted to do was either ride on the L or ride on the subway, and that wonderful, wonderful quality of that noise and that racket.
Yes. Coming back to the making of the art, after you experience these things, do you sketch while you're there, or do you wait until an idea builds strong enough and then do it later? How do you go about making an artwork?
I do a lot of drawing. I always have sketchbooks with me. But for the most part, I just like to sit and watch. And then usually these images come back to me later on. Of course, they metamorphize in different ways, too, and sometimes they become more fanciful. And, you know, L-trains, which are up on, they're not suspended, but they ride above the ground. They're on steel girders, and sometimes I like to change these girders into vine-like girders or more organic type looking, and so that sometimes the steel will metamorphize into organic structures, and so it, you know, the impression you get, it goes through many changes in your mind, and then eventually comes out somehow differently. And so I don't specifically, for a while I was taking photographs of, I would go into Chicago and I'd take black and white photographs of things, and then I would take the photographs and see how I could adapt that into an etching, and I found that it didn't work somehow, because what I was doing was not what I had intended to do. It was better if I let that visual impression implant itself in my mind, and then later come out, you know, change somehow. So I don't do the photographs anymore, and I do sketches. And I think I just do sketches because I love to draw. They don't even relate to the paintings I do, but I just love to do a lot of drawing. And so I've got lots of notebooks of drawings that I've done.
On both your prints and your paintings, you make an awful lot of changes. Mm-hmm. Now, that implies that you had an idea and you were excited about it, and as it got down on the plate or on the paper, it didn't seem to work out quite right. And then you change it, and then you change it. How much of the creative process or the artistic process influences the idea, how does that? What's important, the stuff that happened during the process, or the initial idea of the experience when you were at the site?
Yeah, Picasso makes an interesting statement: an artist gets an idea and then he seeks to destroy it by making it visible. In some way, there's something true about that. You have the wonderful idea in your head, this ideal vision of something that you're going to work, and then you try to make it real, material, and of course it never looks like that marvelous image that you have originally. So what I do is I just have to go with, I guess any artist has to go with what's in front of them. So as I work, things change, and then if I see some direction, I'll go that way. But it goes through many changes till it reaches the end. And then once the painting is done, I'm still not satisfied. I usually hang it in the house, and if it doesn't sit well with me, because it's just like anything else, after you live with something for a while, the mistakes get to be worse, and the bad parts seem to even glare out at you, and the good parts get better. So, you know, after having it on the wall for maybe a couple months, I'll see something that needs to be changed. And I find that the paintings I'm working on like that, I'll spend a year and a half before I'm finished. They'll go through many changes. And finally, after sitting, and it seems to sit well with me after a period of time, and then I feel comfortable with it, and then I'll put it in an exhibition. But it is. I think that this is a very, there's no clear-cut idea as to how I judge it. It's just a way of how that painting feels to me.
Yeah. The illuminated paintings, the illuminated city paintings, appear to have that quality of being many-layered.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Those were very much, even though they tend to be more spontaneous looking, they are over a period of time, you know, worked.
And that painting called High School, was that the title of it?
Yes.
One of the students asked you in a gallery talk, you put yourself in it at the bottom, very small.
Yes.
And you also put light poles like dominate the picture, and you're real small. And you also put your parents in it, and yet you drew your parents from the back rather than from the front. Can you explain why these symbols are small and other symbols are big, and also like the reasons why you decided to show your parents from the back view rather than the front, and also you wearing a baseball cap and a uniform?
Yeah. Like I said, most of my, I think, is very autobiographical, and as I get older, I think they become more specific. And the parents, my parents, I think that we all have a certain way we remember people that have been close to us in our lives. And, you know, it may be even your mother washing dishes in the sink or, you know, doing something not very important in daily activity. And for me, at least, I think just a position. I know once I was in Paris, I saw a woman in front of me, and she happened to be making a very common move. And all of a sudden, I was struck by that. If I could have just frozen that image in time, there was something very touching. I was very, I don't know why I was moved by that, but it was, maybe it was reminiscent of something that I had seen before in artwork, or a kind of universal pose that, but you know, all of a sudden it really made a profound impression on me. And I think that, like, that view of my parents, somehow I think seeing my father walking in that direction was, rather than seeing his face, even, you don't see their faces, you see the back view. It's just a certain, for some reason I felt that's the way I had to represent him, because I thought that was a profound pose to me.
Something so you
that
broke
was,
it down to the essence of what
tried
they
to
are.
Get it at the essence of what they were to me, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
And
visually,
yes, and how I remembered them. Because my father used to always wear a top hat. You don't see men wearing top hats anymore. And a certain kind of overcoat. And so that then was very important to me. And now, as far as myself, I was very much into athletics in high school. I played basketball, and I was, you know, rah-rah and all that. And then used to wear the letter jacket and all that, the accoutrements of a high school jock.
Now why were you so small and these light posts, like dominating even the skyscrapers in that building? I mean, they go from it's a huge painting. What's the dimensions of that painting?
Well, I think it's about 48 inches high and about 60 inches wide.
Yeah, and these light posts go vertically up the thing, and they go from bottom to the top of the paper. Why are those so big?
And they're asymmetrical.
Yeah. They're, I don't know. I have certain visual symbols that I have attached, that have become attached to me, and I can't explain, like light posts, streetcars, some other things that, in particular, that keep popping up. And I don't know why. I think, for one thing, they're good the compositional elements in a painting, because the way I work, it kind of unites the top of the painting with the bottom of the painting, you see. These huge light posts will bring your eye up and down.
They provide a frame within a frame.
Right, and they help that. And so that's, I guess, why I use them. But I do love light posts. I don't know why. But they're important to me.
So the pictures are basically a collection of symbols and
visual symbols,
and according to their importance at the time you're making the painting, the symbols gain size. Would you say?
Yeah, maybe they become
or attention,
more important.
If not size. Yeah, you know, attention can be created by color as well as size.
Right, and like the illuminated paintings, the illumination is coming from the light posts.
Okay.
During the second part of our program, I want to ask you about rug collecting, and particularly Oriental rugs. And it seems to me that those two asymmetrical light posts look a little bit like minarets. And let me ask you about that. We're going to be taking a short news break. I'm here with regular co-host David Feinberg, sculptor and associate professor of studio arts here at the University of Minnesota. And our special guest is John Knutson, who has a show running at the University of Minnesota Gallery in the Studio Arts Building. And we'll be back after the short news break.